And from the KTOO Newsroom in Juneau, I'm Yvonne Crumry. In the fall of 2021, a powerful windstorm swept across Juneau. It blew down dozens of trees across town, crushing cars and causing power outages that lasted days in some neighborhoods. Years later, some distinctive damage remains. A strange jumble of fallen trees at Ocknew Cove caught the eye of one curious Juneau listener. And KTOO's Anna Canny reports those trees might be evidence of one of Juneau's weirdest weather phenomena.
If you look across Ocknew Cove from the parking lot of the Juneau Ferry Terminal, there's a strange cluster of fallen trees, about a dozen that are all splayed out in different directions. They caught the attention of Jesse Escamilla on his evening commute.
I remember it almost looking like someone, like with a bulldozer, went and purposefully like just flattened that whole area. And it looked odd, like it was isolated.
Escamilla was used to seeing a downed tree or two in the wooded area near his home. But so many trees in what seemed like a random area of town, it seemed mysterious. The way they fan out in a sort of circular pattern reminded Escamilla of the mark he had seen tornadoes leave when he was growing up in Texas. So that became one of his two working theories.
Option one would be Godzilla, and option two would be a tornado. Both of those were viable, in my opinion.
But National Weather Service meteorologist Rick Fritz had a different idea.
That sounds a whole lot like a microburst.
In simple terms, a microburst happens when a really strong gust of wind comes down from the sky.
Basically straight down.
The gust comes down fast towards the earth.
And it hits going straight down and goes out in every direction.
And as the winds gush outwards, they can exceed 100 miles per hour.
That's the microburst.
A microburst can cause a lot of damage in a very small area, just like what Escamilla saw at Ocknew Cove. In other places, microbursts often come down with thunderstorms. When storm clouds fill up with rain or hail, they get heavy. And if they get too heavy, they might drop down some weight in the form of a microburst. But thunderstorms are rare in Juneau. And that's not what happened in the storm back in October 2021. The alternative is even more interesting. It has to do with how wind interacts with Juneau's coastal mountains.
How do you get these winds flowing the way they do? The topography on the inside is everything.
Wind, like all weather in Southeast Alaska, is heavily influenced by Juneau's terrain. The fallen trees at Ocknew Cove can likely be linked to something called the mountain wave phenomenon. Winds can come in from Canada, and when they hit Juneau's mountains, they're forced upward. The wind rises up until it hits a mass of stable air that sits high in the sky, and that pushes it back down.
So it comes back down, there's a little bit of a rebound that goes beyond where it was, and it oscillates back and forth.
Those opposing forces make the wind move in a wave motion. When there are really strong winds and a really stable air mass around Gatineau Channel, that wave action is what creates the famed Haku winds in downtown Juneau. But mountain waves can also cause microbursts. In some cases, clouds form under the mountain waves. And when the windy waves pass over the top of the cloud, there's friction.
So, it begins to spin. That's the rotor cloud.
Clouds rotate sideways, with a strong updraft on the side closest to the mountain and a strong downdraft on the far side. You might see where this is going. As wind gusts come over the mountain, they can get caught in these rotor clouds, spiraling and speeding up.
It may have been that you had this air that hit the Mendenhall Peninsula, and it rose, and it got trapped in a rotor, and on the far side of the rotor, it went straight down.
And that's a microburst. When that happens, it has the potential to cause Godzilla-sized damage. In Juneau, I'm Anna Canny.
And Southeast Alaska trollers will now have a summer season for king salmon after all. The U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals Wednesday morning ordered a stay of an earlier lower court ruling that would have closed the fishery indefinitely. KCEW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Alaska Trollers Association President Matt Donahoe was parked in his car when the email came through. He is rarely at a loss for words, but this news left him feeling elated and, for a moment, speechless.
Over the moon, but I'm so in shock and shaky that, just emotionally that I don't know what to think. I mean, I do know what to think. It's great news.
Back in May, the U.S. District Court of Western Washington had ruled in favor of an environmental group seeking to halt commercial trolling for king salmon in Southeast. The Wild Fish Conservancy argued that the National Marine Fisheries Service had failed to comply with the Endangered Species Act in allowing the fishery, and that a population of about 72 southern resident killer whales were suffering as a result. The lower court vacated the language authorizing trolling, effectively blocking the season, which begins on July 1st. The National Marine Fisheries Service, the State of Alaska, and the Trollers Association asked the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals for a stay of that ruling no later than June 23rd. That the decision came 2 days early was almost as surprising as the outcome.
We were fairly certain that we were going to have a decision on the motion of the stay, but what that decision was going to be, we didn't know.
A call to the Wild Fish Conservancy has not yet been returned. Hundreds of pages of motions have been filed in the federal court since the Wild Fish Conservancy first gave notice that it intended to sue the National Marine Fisheries Service in late 2019. The Ninth Circuit's stay order, however, is only 5 pages and among the most concise legal language of the entire case, stating, "A flawed agency rule does not need to be vacated on remand and instead may be left in place when equity demands." This is legalese for don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. Having the National Marine Fisheries Service fix its language has been the crux of this case since it was filed, rather than identifying any specific harm from a relatively small fishery on the welfare of killer whales 800 miles away. It just took 3 years for the courts to spell it out.
That language has been there in front of us all along.
Deborah Lyons represents commercial fisheries on the northern panel of the Pacific Salmon Commission.
That just because the ruling was flawed doesn't mean the fishery absolutely must be closed, although that has been like typical court procedure that the permit has to go away if the document is flawed. But it clearly left room to make an argument that, you know, if there are extenuating circumstances, you don't just close a fishery reflexively.
Those extenuating circumstances involve a 40% loss in income for the roughly 800 permit holders who would put out their hooks on July 1st. The total harvest for commercial trollers this season is 149,000 kings, not a large take compared to other Alaska salmon fisheries like Bristol Bay sockeye, but the kings are incredibly valuable and central to the Southeast Alaska identity and lifestyle for over a century. Lyons believes salmon trollers, who are sometimes confused with trawlers, an altogether different kind of industry, were slow to tell this story.
And I think a lot of people just assumed, well, you're guilty, you're catching fish the whales need, you should go out of work. You know, it was that simple in people's minds. They did not understand the tiny amount of fish that we were catching, you know, the amount of scrutiny we're under. And we made not a great case defending ourselves on that front.
There was consistent support for trollers across the region as the case progressed. Alaska's congressional delegation weighed in with an amicus brief, and just last week, so did the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska. "They're our first line," said Lyons. "That's our food source in rural communities." Alaska Department of Fish and Game Commissioner Doug Vincent Lang had praise for the State Department of Law, but he also believes that it took a group effort to win the stay.
I'm incredibly proud of the coalition that gathered together to get people in line and supportive of the appeal, and I'm certainly happy that Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals agreed with us.
Winning the stay doesn't necessarily mean winning the appeal. There is still much work to be done, both at the agency level and in the courts. In the meantime, Vincent Lang says trollers can return to their work.
We will open the fishery on July 1st.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
And some Alaska lawmakers are holding out hope for a groundswell of support to override Governor Mike Dunleavy's line item budget veto on public school funding. Representative Calvin Schrage is an anchored nonpartisan who leads the House's largely Democratic minority caucus. He says he asked House Speaker Kathy Tilton, a Wasilla Republican, on Wednesday to poll House members about holding a special session to attempt veto overrides.
I think it's important that we at least do our due diligence in taking the time to figure out where members are at and whether two-thirds of the members of the legislature support going to special session to override this veto.
The legislature can call a special session with the vote of two-thirds of its members. If a special session is convened, then there's an even higher bar to override budget vetoes. That would take three-quarters or 45 members of the full legislature. Draghi says he heard back from Tilton Thursday. She told him an informal poll of her members led her to believe there wasn't anywhere close to the votes for a special session. Tilton's caucus of mostly Republicans has the votes to make or break both supermajority votes. The governor's veto to public school funding was the single biggest budget reduction he made. You're listening to KTOO. It's just about 4 o'clock.